Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. International donors have failed to deliver $1.9 billion in promised funds to help West African countries recover from the Ebola epidemic that has killed more than 11,000 people and decimated an already weak healthcare system, according to the UK-based charity Oxfam Sunday. The remaining $3.9 billion pledged has been difficult to track because of scant information and a lack of transparency, according to the group. An African Union summit has ended with a proposed peacekeeping force for troubled Burundi put on hold, as leaders say they will not send in troops without the government's consent. The bloc's leaders instead said they will send a high-level delegation to Burundi to push for talks between the government and its opponents, as well as to urge the government to accept peacekeepers there. The United States aid agency has announced $97 million in emergency assistance for Ethiopia to help address the ongoing humanitarian crisis resulting from the impacts of the El Nino phenomenon. The United States government is helping Ethiopians cope with the impacts of El Nino, and our additional assistance will build on the ongoing response effort. That is according to Gail Smith, the USAID administrator, in a statement released on Sunday. A military general who opposes Uganda's longtime president has been arrested, according to his lawyer. He says General David Sejusa, who has called President Yoweri Museveni a dictator, is being detained at a military barracks in the Ugandan capital of Kampala. Sejusa's arrest is likely to raise tensions before presidential elections February 18th. Neither the government nor the military has commented on why he was detained. You're listening to VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry appealed on Sunday to both sides to continue Syrian peace talks in Geneva, despite an attack by the Islamic State bombers that killed more than 60 people near the country's holiest shrine. Kerry spoke in a televised statement.
The world is hoping that both sides will move quickly to meet the needs of millions of desperate Syrians, to reduce the pressure on neighboring countries, to reduce the levels of migration, and to help restore peace and stability. The main topics on the agenda for these negotiations include arrangements for a nationwide ceasefire and establishing a path to a political transition that will bring this conflict to an end.
Syria's main opposition group met with UN mediator Stephane de Mistura for the first time on Sunday. Representatives of the Higher Negotiation Committee demanded efforts to improve humanitarian conditions on the ground, threatening that they would shun political negotiations if this does not occur. The HNC spokesman Salim al-Muslat commented on the meeting as it was still ongoing.
We're optimistic and we're here to really find a solution for all Syrians, no matter what side they are on. We are here to find Syria, to see Syria free of terrorism, free of dictatorship, for all Syrians.
The HNC delegation says it's seeking to halt attacks on civilian areas, the release of detainees, and the lifting of blockades. The talks in Geneva comes as the Islamic State has claimed a triple bombing in the southern Damascus suburb Sunday that killed at least 60 people, as we mentioned earlier in the broadcast. Two suicide bombers detonated explosives as rescue efforts were underway after a car bombing in the Said Zainab district of Damascus near a revered Shiite shrine. Shiite fighters are among the dead in the predominantly Shiite city, according to the AFP. The area has come under attack before with several bombings near the shrine in recent years. Over 10,000 unaccompanied migrant children have disappeared in Europe. That's according to the EU police agency Europol Sunday, fearing that many have been whisked into sex trafficking rings or the slave trade. Europol's press office confirmed to AFP the figures published in the British newspaper Observer, adding that they covered the last 18 to 24 months. This comes as at least 37 migrants, including several children, died Saturday when the boat meant to take them to the Greek island of Lesbos sank off Turkey's western coast. The death toll rose late Saturday after search crews found more bodies trapped inside the 17-meter craft. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The African Union is quite pleased. The 26th summit has been ongoing in a very serene atmosphere. People have been interacting with each other.
African leaders conclude a two-day summit in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
Idris Deby, who is now the chair of the African Union, he say, why would we even wait for tomorrow? We need to silence the gun today.
The newly elected chairman of the African Union, Chadian President Idris Deby, vows urgency to help end conflict on the continent.
The latest moment is that he is now being kept in the military prison at Makindye, suburb in Kampala.
And Ugandan opposition and civil society groups condemn the arrest of renegade Army General David Sejusa on Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African leaders discuss steps that need to be taken towards the domestication of the African Union's Agenda 2063 and the steps of implementation for the first 10 years of the plan in member countries. Jacob Eno Eben, spokesperson for the chairperson of the African Union Commission, said the leaders also focused on mobilizing resources to facilitate the implementation of the key project they identified. This was after Chadian President Idris Deby was elected chairman of the African Union. Eben told me the African Union is ready to provide assistance as well as monitor elections in member countries, including Uganda and Ghana, to ensure peace and stability during and after the election.
The African Union is quite pleased. The 26th summit has been ongoing in a very serene atmosphere. People have been interacting with each other and the heads of state, I think for the first time, had an opportunity to meet among themselves in the very first part of the morning in a very closed, in what they describe as a closed session. They talked about Agenda 2063 and how they have to accelerate the implementation and domestication of Agenda 2063 in the various member states, the implementation of the first 10-year plan of Agenda 2063 and the need to mobilize necessary resources to facilitate the integration, the implementation of all flagship projects that they have identified.
On the issue of peace and security, there are flashpoints in Burundi and South Sudan that readily come in mind. What are some of the issues that have come up with discussions among heads of state and government and how to resolve some of these challenges on the continent, as well as terrorism?
Well, maybe one thing I should also note is that the Peace and Security Council at the level of heads of state, but they had to discuss issues of terrorism and also South Sudan. Issues of terrorism remains a challenge on the continent that they accepted. But they also recognize that enormous effort has been put in by the Union, by the regional economic communities, by also some of the countries that are directly impacted, but that whilst we're seeing gains in areas like in Somalia, how much they have been able to push back Al-Shabaab, and even in Nigeria, how the president talked about, you know, the Boko Haram haven't really been, you know, pushed back to a point where they are almost trying to completely clear Boko Haram out of Nigeria, but they recognize that the challenge of terrorism and extremism. So they looked at it not only from the point of being reactive, it also talked about focusing on preventive diplomacy and looking at issues of managing diversity and also information sharing for them to be able to close their ranks and defeat and overcome these challenges.
This year, we'll see some countries on the continent holding elections. Just next month, Uganda holds election, general election. In November, Ghana does as well, among other countries that will be holding elections this year. What is the sense of the African Union, and did the leaders talk about the need to monitor to ensure credible election, if possible, to avoid violence, among other issues ahead of these elections?
As we look forward to the upcoming elections in this year, it is important to underscore the need for active participation and free engagement of all the actors in a manner that can really facilitate transitions in instances where the people will have to decide that they want a change. And so the African Union will continue to observe elections on the continent in the different countries, whether they are local or parliamentary, because the Union doesn't observe, the Commission doesn't observe local elections. They do observe the legislative and presidential elections. And so they're mobilizing the necessary resources, both financial and human resources, so that they assist, accompany the countries that will be going into elections to ensure that the elections are organized in peaceful and conducive environment.
Jacob Eno Eben is the spokesperson for the chairperson of the African Union Commission. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Meanwhile, the African Union plans to send a delegation to Burundi to help ease tension and encourage dialogue between the government and opposition groups to resolve the crisis. Binta Diop, the African Union Special Envoy on Women, Peace and Security, told me the AU has demonstrated commitment towards resolving conflict on the continent.
What I realized for this summit is that they are really taking the matter seriously. I can tell you when I hear Idris Deby, who is now the chair of the African Union, he say, why would we even wait for tomorrow? We need to silence the gun today, and we need to be serious about what we say, and all of us take action. So I think this is very strong in terms of commitment. As you know, this year is the year of women's rights. And you know, women suffer a lot in the conflict. They are the ones that have been used and abused. So women are pushing, and I think the head of state received the call of the young people as well to say it's time for development.
But what do you say to critics who say that the Peace and Security Council of the African Union and the African Union in general has not been forceful enough to force a solution to resolving the conflict in both Burundi and South Sudan? What do you say to such criticisms?
Yeah, I think that, the people are waiting, and they have been waiting for long. One single death in Burundi or South Sudan need to be, is enough to go and intervene. But sovereign states, as you know, the organization, either it is the AU or the UN, because at the end of the day, the UN is the one who have in their hands the peace and security of the world. But, they go into process. I think what they have achieved this time is really to send a team of leaders to go and sit and discuss dialogue, because at the end of the day, all conflict that you see, violent or not, should be resolved through dialogue. That's the reality. On the issue of South Sudan, they are also pushing by sending President Mokai, who was the former president of Botswana, to make sure that he puts the two together. I think it's slow for the people, and I understand it's slow for the population, but I think the AU is very strong in the process, and they will not let them sleep until they resume and they they silence the gun and get back South Sudan and Burundi in the continent agenda for peace.
Now, Madam Diop, what do you see as the commitment of Idriss Deby after he was elected as the chairman to take over from President of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe? What is the commitment and the support given by other heads of state and government in terms of resolving conflict on the continent to save women and children from suffering from these conflicts?
I think he was very strong. We found Deby very strong in terms of chairmanship. Succeeding to Mugabe is not easy, but he say, no, I want action. Let's go to the action right now. I think the first thing is, you know, the AU, we have a budget in terms of peacekeeping and sending our troops and so on, a lot of money. But what we decide to do is to convene an extraordinary head of state meeting to say we need to put the money ourselves, the resources, African resources. I think this is very good.
What do you see as the prospect of silencing the gun on the continent as espoused by the African Union and subsequently by the Peace and Security Council?
If women sit at the table, we silence the gun. You know why? What I said is when it comes to resolving the conflict, women have an agenda. The men who are sitting, most of the time when I attended peace talk, men are sharing the power.
Madam Binta Diop is the African Union Special Envoy on Women, Peace and Security. She spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Opposition and civil society groups have condemned the arrest of renegade Army General David Sejusa after military officers surrounded his house in Nagoro in the Ugandan capital Kampala on Sunday. Sejusa's attorney Ladislaw Rakafuzi says his arrest was illegal since the army had no arrest warrant and refused to explain the circumstances that led to the arrest. He told me Sejusa's arrest could be strongly linked to the upcoming election since he has been advising opposition leaders on ways to prevent rigging of the upcoming elections.
The latest development is that he is now being kept in the military prison at Makindye, a military a suburb in Kampala.
What led to his arrest?
This morning around between 9 and 10 o'clock, military police surrounded his home. When they surrounded his home, they picked him. So when they picked him, I was informed by somebody from his household about it. I tried to call my client. He could not take his calls, and it seems he was being prevented from answering his phones. Then he was picked, and then later I learned that he was taken to Makindye the military prison. And I have not been able to go to the prison because the military do not normally allow people, especially when they have just been arrested, they will not allow me inside the prison.
Did they tell you the reason why he was arrested, and did they have a warrant of arrest?
No, there was no warrant of arrest, which is illegal. Therefore, the arrest is illegal. There was no warrant of arrest, nor was it sanctioned by the court beforehand. Whether the military court or the civil court, none of the courts sanctioned the arrest, and there was no warrant of arrest. No official reason has been stated as to his arrest.
General Sejusa, your client, has been faulted recently of behavior unbecoming and bringing disrepute to the army with his accusations against the commander-in-chief, in this case, General Museveni, when the Army Code of Ethics prevents him from doing so.
That one cannot be correct. The military, he is no longer in the military. He was constructively discharged from the military. For the last 4 years, he's not deployed. He's not being paid a salary. He has no uniform.
He has no communication from the army. He's not. He has no position in the army, and he applied for retirement, which is allowed under the law, and they have never replied him, and which means under the law, it means he has been constructively discharged from the army, and he has never applied to join the army. He went to the bush, which was a collective effort of the youth. Youthful young men in the mid 80s, in the early 80s, and when they went there, they had one purpose, to overthrow what they called a dictatorship at the time. He never wanted to be a career soldier, and when he had played his role in what he called the liberation of the country, he wanted to leave and do politics. He has always been wanted to join politics, and that's why he can only be, you know, has been kept in the army against his will since 1995. Has been wanting to leave the army since 1995.
But he has yet to be officially retired from the army, and the army has procedures to go by. So if he has yet to be officially allowed to retire or be given the permission to retire, he's still in the army. Do you agree to that?
No, I think now this one is a question of law. We want to interpret. If I make an application to be retired, and the law says that a person who has served in the army for at least 13 years can apply to be retired, and he has applied to be retired, and for 2 years there has been no reply, and yet at the same time he's not deployed, he's not being paid a salary. So what does that mean? It betokens that he is no longer in the army, and that he has been allowed to leave the army. And that's why he has been playing politics, and that's what he wants to do. He's an opposition advisor. He's advising the KRSG and other opposition people on how to be there in the opposition and make sure that they win in the coming election. Actually, his arrest has nothing to do with the military. It's because he has been playing politics. It's because of this coming election, which I think President Museveni fears he might lose to Dr. Besigye, and he thinks that General Segusa is helping Dr. Besigye with a lot of advice on how to make sure that the civilians do not allow to be cheated in this coming election.
Has his family been able to visit him as well?
No.
Ladislaw Rakafuzi is the attorney of the Ugandan Renegade Army General David Segusa. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. On January 5th, 2016, Zambian President Edgar Lungu agreed to amendment to the constitution. They are said to help the document more people-driven, or in other words, meeting the aspirations of the people. From the Zambian capital, Lusaka, Alexander Mutali has the story.
Since independence from Britain in 1964, Zambia has had three constitutions, but none that has represented the aspirations of the citizens. That's because in the first few decades of independence, the presidents and their cabinets rejected most of the public's suggestions. Instead, they themselves determined what was to be included in the constitutions. This time, a constitutional review commission solicited personal opinions in town halls and public meetings. A technical committee of experts passed on the suggestions to parliament, which approved the reforms by a two-thirds majority. Gideon Mwewa is a constitutional scholar at Cavendish University in Lusaka, Zambia. He says the new amendments have popular support and are therefore more people-driven than the previous ones.
It certainly is going to make the constitution a better one, because the inclusions have been what the people have been demanding for.
Under the amended constitution and the current one, elections are guaranteed every 5 years. Ordinarily, the president would set the exact date. With the new reforms, elections will be held every 5 years on the second Thursday of August. A president can only serve for 2 5-year terms. Voters will cast their ballots for the president directly, with the winning candidate gaining more than 50% of the votes cast. If at the final count a candidate has not received that amount, a second ballot shall be held within 37 days of the initial vote between the two leading politicians. Previously, a president was elected by simple majority. The new reforms also affect the office of the vice president. Previously, the president could hire or even fire the vice president, who also had no specific term of office. But now, each presidential candidate has a vice presidential running mate, and voters select them as a team, not separately. The president cannot dismiss the vice president, who will automatically take over if the president dies before the end of their term. Zambians submitted this requirement after two presidents died in office between 2008 and 2014. The government was forced to organize unplanned snap elections to choose a new president, an exercise that proved very costly. Anyone who has twice held the office of vice president cannot be selected as a running mate. Constitutional scholar Gideon Mwewa says he believes these new provisions will stand the test of time, though he says it's natural that constitutions evolve to keep up with societal changes.
Whatever law that a country may make for itself, including constitution, is bound to be changed at some point or the other as society changes.
The Bill of Rights is the only part of the constitution that could not be amended by parliament. It requires a referendum to take place on August 11th alongside the general elections. The revised Bill of Rights guarantees access to information and freedom of the media. Everyone will have the right of access to information held by the state. The government shall not exercise control over or interfere with a person engaged in broadcasting or the production or circulation of publications or the dissemination of information through any media. Freedom of Expression activists say they expect the new reforms to also guarantee greater transparency and fairness in the state-owned media as well. For VOA, I'm Alexander Mtale in Lusaka, Zambia.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. Up, I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series in Daily Quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the African Union Summit Year of Human Rights, with a particular focus on women's rights. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC as they discuss human rights. That's next time on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, traditional music. Are you a big fan? Does it bring good memories to you? Who is your favorite traditional music artist? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing traditional music. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sport. And for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin with the African Nations Championship Tournament, CHAN, in Rwanda. Mali came from a goal down to defeat and eject one of the tournament's favorites, Tunisia, 2-1 in the quarterfinals Sunday. Mali now faces Ivory Coast in the semifinals. Ivory Coast needed extra time to get past Cameroon, exploding for three quick goals to win 3-0 on Saturday. DR Congo became the first team to qualify for the semifinals of CHAN 2016, beating hosts Rwanda 2-1 after extra time in Saturday's first quarterfinal. The Leopards dominated the first half and rediscovered their best form in extra time, finding a winner in the second half. DR Congo now faces the winner of Sunday's other quarterfinal match between Zambia and Guinea in Wednesday's semifinal. DR Congo won the inaugural CHAN title in 2009. The African Nations Championship Tournament is only open to national players who play in their local league. However, other African players are continuing to go professional, especially in leagues in Europe. My colleague Sunny Young caught up with the African football guru, David Legg, for more on this. Sunny?
David, Uganda's teenage captain, 19-year-old Farouk Mia, you have billed him as a player to watch. Mia heading to Belgium. How about some details for our VOA football fans?
The details, Sunny, are that the transfer itself will cost $400,000. Now, what remains, Sonny, is for Mia to agree on personal terms with the Belgians. I sincerely hope he does, because this is a golden opportunity for this teenager who, as you said, has been really rising fast. He's been scoring goals for the Olympic team, and in the CHAN tournament, in their first match against Mali, which finished in a 2-2 draw, Mia created the first goal with one of his beautifully flighted free kicks, and then he converted very calmly a penalty to give the Ugandans the lead for the second time. But unfortunately, they couldn't hold on, and in the end, the match was drawn. But he is a star prospect. And although you have quite a few Ugandans, Sunny, scattered around the world playing professional football, you don't really have many among the top leagues. I suppose what Mia is thinking of is that if he can do well at Stand at the Edge, and obviously he's got to walk before he runs, then one of the top leagues could beckon. And those top leagues in Europe, as far as the Voice of America are concerned, are England, Italy, Spain, France and Germany. Other news, Sunny, Christian Atsu. Now, Christian Atsu in 2015 scored the best goal at the Africa Cup of Nations tournament, and he was also voted the best player of the tournament. But since then, he's basically disappeared off the face of the earth. He belongs to Chelsea, who bought him from Porto, but they keep loaning him out. They loaned him to Vitesse in the Netherlands. They then lent him to Everton in England. And more recently, they lent him to Bournemouth, the newcomers to the English Premier League. Now, when he went to Bournemouth, one of the Bournemouth officials said that it was a huge coup to get Atsu to the Cherries, as they're known. But unfortunately, he just didn't make an impression. He only played twice in the League Cup. He never played in the Premier League, didn't even make the matchday squad. And now, in his latest move, he's decided to swap England for Spain. He's moving on loan from Chelsea to Malaga. And we, Sonny, must wish him the very best, because clearly, since Equatorial Guinea at the start of last year, his career has nosedived. He keeps getting lent, but he's not making an impression. So let's hope for a change in fortune when Christian Atsu goes to Malaga.
Another move, David, involving a veteran player from Ivory Coast heading to the Far East. What's the latest there, David?
Right, Sonny, the man in question is Gervinho. I think Gervinho's getting towards the end of his career, and he's obviously looking for those big payouts. And while I have some reservations about the standard of Chinese football. They do pay very well, so he's off to play club football there. He's leaving Roma. That's a big change, Sonny. He's going from one of the top leagues in Europe to, I guess, one of the top leagues in Asia, but there's a big difference in standards. But I guess as you get into your 30s and you can see the sort of sun setting in the distance, those paychecks can mean a lot. And it'll be interesting to see how it fares, Sonny, because Didier Drogba, the Ivory Coast icon, he also went to China. He made a lot of money, but he quickly realized that the standard of football there was essentially dragging him down. He was losing his sharpness. He was losing his touch. He moved to Turkey, and then he moved back to England, and he's now, of course, playing for Montreal Impact in Major League Soccer in the United States and Canada. But Gervinho obviously believes he's making the right decision, so we can only wish him well, and we'll keep an eye, Sonny, on his progress. We won't know much about the bank balance, but we'll watch what he's doing on the field.
David, another move that's been signed, sealed, and delivered, and that you actually tipped on a previous show. Emmanuel Adebayor signs with Crystal Palace, short-term deal. Your reaction?
Yeah, Sonny, this is one we're going to have to watch extra, extra carefully. Adebayor has, he's a very much a yo-yo man. He's up and down. He's got a lot of talent, but he can be a very troublesome character. But as we said, Crystal Palace manager, Alan Pardew, he says he can cope with the troublesome Adebayor. So we'll just wait and see. The thing with Adebayor, of course, is physically, he's so big, he's so tall, he's so strong, and he can be a real menace in the penalty area. And Pardew is very worried about Crystal Palace. He feels they're just not scoring enough goals, and he's banking on resurrecting the career of Adebayor. And this is a player who earns, reportedly, £100,000 a week. That's an awful, awful lot of money. And it's going to be interesting to see now if he can repay the faith of Alan Pardew. Interestingly, Sonny, I was watching the reaction of some of the English pundits, and the majority believe that it's a good signing, that Pardew can actually get Adebayor back on the straight and narrow. We'll just have to wait and see, Sonny.
Our African football guru, Dev Legg, is speaking from Johannesburg with my colleague, Sonny Young. And finally, in tennis, world number one Novak Djokovic beat Andy Murray in straight sets to win his sixth Australian Open title. The Serb, who is 28, won 6-1, 7-5, 7-6, 7-3 to claim his sixth Melbourne title, tying the record of Australia's Roy Emerson. Djokovic also draws level with tennis greats Bjorn Borg and Rod Laver on 11 Grand Slam titles. Second seed, 28-year-old Murray, has now lost all five Australian Open finals he has played, four of them against Djokovic. Djokovic has now won four of the past five major tournaments, including three in a row, and will try to complete his career Grand Slam with the first French Open title in June. Meanwhile, on Saturday, Angelique Kerber staged a stunning upset of number one ranked Serena Williams to win her first major at the Australian Open. Williams, the world number one, was the defending champion and a six-time tournament winner. As strong as Williams is, she could not quite push through the pressure of history and a free-swinging Kerber, who pulled off the 6-4, 3-6, 6-4 upset at Rod Laver Arena. Kerber, who is 28, was the first seventh-seeded player to win the title since Williams in 2005, and the first to beat Williams in a three-set major final. And that's it for this week's Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Yeah.
Girls of nowadays, they don't believe, yeah. Sometimes I wonder why they know they see, yeah. Confess all your love, they don't go greedy, they don't go greedy. They don't just want to believe the love, not really, yeah. What the is wrong with me? Why do I keep falling for this kind of girl? What the
is wrong with you? Can't you see my love, you know, be like a sugar baby. You sweet in my belly, you know, be like a funny. Let me walk back, I me go. My sugar. I like to know, below me, do I need to know, yeah? I like to know, yeah. Baby, when you go believe, say now until I commit, say now then you go believe, you're like the opportunity, oh. Baby, when you go believe, say now until I commit, say now then you go believe, Mama Jenkara, me see a long way. Chai, what the is wrong with me? Why do I keep falling for this kind of girl?
Canteen. Now, we know a baby matter. Daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now, we don't talk to butter. Family to smile and we know the quanta. That could just say Yoruba. Make them know go forget say Badona Baba. Kardashian, hey, in the back of my brand new Bentley.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. 12 years ago, the major players in the international community were wringing their hands and expressing profound remorse that they had failed to prevent the genocide in Rwanda. Subsequently, some of the major powers did express some responsibility and express regret to the people of Rwanda and stated that this would never, never happen again. Now, 8 months ago, Pierre Nkurunziza of Burundi set in motion another factor that may lead to destabilization in Burundi. Defying the international community, he went ahead for a third term, and this was widely interpreted as a violation of the Arusha Accord, which had brought peace and stability to Burundi. The consequences was that many Burundians had to fled their country and took refuge in neighboring countries. There were reports of killings in and around the country. There were failed coups and now the creation of another opposition party. Just last week, Amnesty International announced that they have discovered 5 mass graves just outside the capital. A few weeks ago, the Peace and Security Council of the African Union decided to send 5,000 strong troops to Burundi to protect civilians and facilitate negotiations. The government then rejected that move, because the force were to enter with or without the agreement of the government. The East African community decided to set up a negotiating team under the auspices of the president of Uganda, President Yoweri. And the government of Burundi decided not to participate because they said some groups should not be a party to the negotiations. And typical of intransigent parties to negotiation, the government announced last week that it will be prepared to join negotiations should South Africa decide to call for a conference. Luckily, South Africa had not fallen for the debate. But these moves were all made because the African Union summit is going on this weekend. And among the things that the summit will discuss is to whether or not to endorse the decision of the Peace and Security Council. There are views now in Addis Ababa that it is not likely that the summit will endorse outright the Peace and Security Council decision. Equally, there are doubts in New York that the Security Council will be prepared to give full support to the African Union Peace and Security Council proposal should it be endorsed by the summit. So here we are again, 12 years and 8 months, and the international community is behaving as it has always done on matters relating to Africa. Feeble action, no strong action, and we may enter into another serious and destabilizing situation in Burundi. I think Africans should take note and see what they can do to protect the people of Africa when faced with such disasters as we are now seeing in Burundi. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, there are many colorful flowers on the path of life, but the prettiest have the sharpest thorns. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In response to worsening drought conditions and increased food insecurity, the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced on January 19th an additional $5 million contribution to the United Nations World Food Program, or WFP, for humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe. This brings total U.S. government funding for humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe to $32.5 million since June 2015, following a poor harvest across the country. According to the Zimbabwe Vulnerability Assessment Committee, an estimated 1.5 million rural Zimbabweans will face serious food shortages in the first 3 months of this year. This figure is likely to increase if El Nino, as predicted, causes continued drought and a poor April-June 2016 harvest. USAID's additional $5 million contribution will support WFP's productive asset creation activity starting in May 2016 and will provide food rations or cash transfers to over 80,000 individuals in 8 districts across Zimbabwe over a 6-month period. In exchange for the food rations or cash transfers, beneficiaries will participate in the creation or rehabilitation of community assets, including irrigation systems and dams, to improve infrastructure and livelihoods for the future. With total contributions of $32.5 million, USAID is working with its implementing partners, World Food Program, World Vision, and Cultivating New Frontiers in Agriculture, to scale up food security programs across 10 districts in Manicaland, Masvingo, and Matabeleland, north and south, reaching 450,000 people with humanitarian assistance. For more than 30 years, the American people, through USAID, have invested over $2.6 billion in Zimbabwe. Current projects include initiatives to increase food security, support economic resilience, improve health systems and services, and advance a more democratic system of governance. USAID is proud to support the World Food Program and help vulnerable Zimbabweans cope through this difficult drought, said USAID Mission Director Stephanie Funk. This program addresses immediate food security needs while gradually helping vulnerable communities build resilience to climatic shocks and eliminating the need for food assistance in the long term.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.